everyone, and welcome to episode 6 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. There are certain stories from the Middle Ages that seem to resonate across the centuries, speaking to situations and generations far removed in time and space from their original audiences. One of these stories seems to be Le Jongleur de Notre Dame, or the Juggler of Our Lady. Although it disappeared for hundreds of years, the story of the Jongleur is one that had a major resurgence in the 19th and 20th centuries, just as medievalism became a lightning rod for discussions of culture, identity, and nation. The evolution of Le Jongleur de Notre Dame is the subject of an exhibit called Juggling the Middle Ages, which is currently on display at the Dumbarton Oaks Research Library and Collection in Washington, D.C. Here to tell us the story, as well as why it's been so important, is Jan Zelkowski, the Arthur Kingsley Porter Professor of Medieval Latin and Professor of Comparative Literature at Harvard, and the Director of Dumbarton Oaks. Well, thanks, Jan, for joining us on the podcast. Thanks for coming and telling us all about the new exhibit at Dumbarton Oaks.
Thank you for allowing me to come, and I'm pleased to talk with you.
It's great to have you. So this exhibit is based on a story from the Middle Ages. So can you tell us a bit about the story?
Sure. So there are two main versions. One survives from the 1230s in a poem in medieval French, a dialect of Old French. And then another version survives from the 1270s in Latin. I can't tell you for certain whether the story was based on an actual incident or whether someone concocted it. We just can't know that. There's evidence that would support either of those arguments. Do you want to hear the story?
I absolutely do. Tell us the story.
Okay, so there's a worldly entertainer, and in the medieval version, he's a tumbler. He's a kind of acrobat who does floor exercises, sort of dancing. He does other sorts of entertaining as well, but that's his forte. And eventually he grows tired of this wayfaring life. He questions what the point of it is. And so he ends up entering a monastery to become a lay brother. And when he gets inside the monastery, he is initially happy because he has a way of showing his devotion, but he ends up soon falling into what we might call a clinical depression because he discovers he doesn't know Latin, and the regular monks do. He can't sing or chant the way that they can. He doesn't know the worship. He doesn't even know the right etiquette for when he should be silent and when he's allowed to speak. And so he just feels useless. And at this point, after being down in this state for a while, he discovers that there is down in the crypt a Madonna, a statue of the Virgin Mary. And so when the monks are up doing their prayers, which they do multiple times a day, he slips down into the basement of the church and does this floor exercise, very strenuous, and keeps doing this for a while and is very happy doing what he's doing. But eventually the monks notice that he's absent, and so two of them follow him and go down to the crypt and see that he strips off most of his clothes. He's basically in his underwear, and he does this this exercise and gets all sweaty, and they're shocked. So they go up to the abbot and they say, Father, one of the lay brothers is doing something that is just so sacrilegious, you've got to see it. So the abbot comes down with them and watches, and initially he's finding what's happening blasphemous too, but then they notice that at the end of the routine, the monk collapses and the Virgin Mary appears live, either the statue comes to life or else the Virgin herself just materializes. And so they realize that this lay brother is holy after all. The story splits at that point, and there are a couple of different endings. In the medieval one, he ends up dying because he keeps doing these exercises. The abbot calls him into his office. He goes in, and he's expecting to be ejected from the abbey, Instead, the abbot says, no, keep doing what you're doing. You're actually doing something pious. And at that point, he's so relieved that the switch from being incredibly anxious to being incredibly relieved and being very tired kills him. So there's another contest at that point. The virgin seizes his soul from the devils that are about to take it, and he ends up going to heaven after all. So there's the story.
That's a beautiful story. It's such a medieval story, especially, you know, dying from the exertion for the virgin's sake. So this story, from what I've read about it on the website for the exhibit, it appeared in a collection of exempla. Is that right?
Well, it's called an exempla in the poem, and then it's in an exemplum collection after that. And then it dies out. So it's gone. It disappears with the end of the Middle Ages and doesn't reappear until 1873. Why it died out, I think, putting it very simply, it was too focused on a layman who has this kind of miraculous triumph without a priest, without the church hierarchy, for Catholicism during the Counter-Reformation, but it's way too saturated in monks and saints and the Virgin for Protestantism. So it didn't satisfy either side, and it died out.
And it was discovered just as medievalism started to be popular at the end of the 19th century. Is that right?
Yes. So you have the Franco-Prussian War, and the French are whooped by the Prussians. The French have to form a new government. They have to figure out what being French is, and they turn to the Middle Ages for this, and they focus on particularly on loser heroes and heroines in the person particularly of Roland in the Song of Roland, a tragic hero, and then on Joan of Arc in the Saints. But then they're also looking for other characters who will exemplify good sides of Frenchness. And one of them that they glom onto is the Jongleur. They see him as being childlike, simple, faithful, pure. And that's something that in the rapidly evolving, and this is a syndrome that we can empathize with readily in our present circumstances. Society is changing quickly. There have been technological changes, changes in government, as I mentioned, and people are craving simplicity, the good old days, and so they turn to the Middle Ages, and so the Jongleur is part of that.
And I think it's a very relatable story as we get into the 20th century, where people are starting to write more novels about outsiders, because this Jongleur is definitely an outsider. So mm-hmm. I think that's definitely relatable as well.
Just on that, because I didn't want to forget that's a really good point. And the Jongleur is also from a late 19th century, a proto-Bohemian. He's a struggling artist, someone who's trying to figure out how the individual relates to the hierarchy, how art relates to broader society.
Yeah. And I think that before we get away from the Jongleur identity, I think it's important that maybe we talk a little bit about what that would have been like in the Middle Ages, because it's often translated in the versions that you have in the exhibit as a juggler, but he's right. More than that, isn't he?
Yes. So the Middle Ages had many, many names for popular entertainers, but most of them were interchangeable and covered a number of different categories. I think most of us, when we think of the Middle Ages, think rapidly of knights, damsels, jesters, hangmen. There's a whole list of things, but jesters are one of them. And we think of entertainers, town criers with horns, and then buffoons and people dancing around. And all of those categories have some truth in them. The jongleur comes from a term that in Latin basically means joker, but it was often used to cover people who told stories. It covered people who engaged in physical talents of being acrobats. It was also people who were musicians. And then in the 19th century in French, it came to be specialized to cover people who juggle, since that word comes from the same etymological root.
Yeah, so that makes sense that he ends up evolving into a juggler later on. But yeah, these were very sophisticated, like street performers like we have now, but a real professional at the time. And but still an outsider in the Middle Ages. So when you talk about his joining the monastery in the story, he was in a position where he was really uneducated and very much on the outside.
And making a huge change, because you've pointed to the fact that they were mobile. These were itinerant entertainers. There weren't big cities where they could set up shop and just stay. To make a living, they had to keep moving around. And they were in a very precarious situation because the Middle Ages had, roughly speaking, two classes of people. The people with, let's say, in modern terms, good passports that would protect them, that were from countries with an apparatus behind them, those were the people who were in the church. And if they committed a crime, they were subject to church law, and they would be punished in one way. The itinerant people, these peripatetic entertainers, were in a much, much more vulnerable class. And if they got caught and they committed a crime, it was losing a hand, having an ear cut off, losing a nose. It wasn't that it was a complete disparity in severity, but there was a lot of difference in the way they were handled. And here he was, going from being this mobile, distrusted sort of person to entering a monastery where one of the most important features of life is stability, staying in one place. You take an oath, you're not going to move. And that's exactly what he does. It's a complete about face.
Yeah. And I like the part of the story where the Virgin has pity on this person who is the complete outsider, because that really speaks to the medieval and even modern or all sorts of Christian ideas where Christianity is available to people who are not necessarily worthy, quote unquote, in doctrinal ways. Mm-hmm. But I like this idea of the outsider being part of French national identity. And one of the things I thought was really interesting looking at the website for the exhibit was how the French used this idea in war, especially in the 20th century.
I was really bowled over. And I've got to say, as far as the sorts of things that I was able to find, it's fascinating as a scholar to be in a position where you can search and find so many different things now, partly because of traditional scholarly search engines, but also because of used book search engines. With a story like this, you can feed in different versions of the title in many different languages and go back every 6 months or so and try again. And sure enough, you'll come up with different versions, which is what led me to this fairly rich harvest of versions from the Second World War, where you have, say, in the Netherlands, you have a founder of the Dutch Nazi Party use the story. You have a devout Christian who was in a concentration camp use the story. You have a Jew who was in hiding for the war use the story. You have many members of the resistance in France use it. You have one member, a high person associated with the Vichy government, use it. And then you have in Germany, a Nazi use it. So there's something very plastic about the story. And I came eventually to think of it as being almost a fictitious sort of bouillon that you can distill this story down to almost nothing and pass it on to another person in a sentence or two, and then fill it out very rapidly on the basis of your own imagination and take it in directions that are slightly different for every person.
Yeah, it seems to really have evolved and meant different things to different people, especially over the 20th century. I mean, you have in the Second World War, people using this as a code name for their spies as well.
Yeah, I mean, one item in the exhibit is a medallion for a colonel in the resistance who called himself the Jongleur de Notre Dame, and who then made his resistance cell the Companions of Notre Dame because they were following him. And he wasn't the only one to seize upon the name in that way.
That's really interesting. And then after the war, so in the 50s, when people are trying to get back to the good old days type idea, you have it being told and told again as part of a Christmas story, especially on television, right?
Yes. So it's drawn into the ever strengthening gravitational field of Christmas, which supports so much commercially. So there's a huge incentive if you're producing a children's book or any sort of book for the retail market to produce it for Christmas. And then there's all the special programming at Christmas. And so there was one year in 1959 where the story was on television in France, in Canada, and in the United States. In the United States, it was on every year for 4 or 5 years on a variety show that Fred Waring did. It was in a cartoon form that came out from the same company that did Mighty Mouse, Deputy Dog, Heckle and Jekyll, in an absolutely brilliant minimalist short that's about 8 minutes. If anyone, it can often be found on YouTube. I cannot recommend it highly enough. The voiceover is done by none other than Boris Karloff, the future Grinch at that point. So, and then in 1960, Tony Curtis did a version of it, a very bizarre version. I won't go into that, but so there. And then there were also 4 movie versions of it that came up in the 60s and 70s.
And then it quieted down, because this is a story that I don't remember having come across, which is surprising because it was so popular in the mid 20th century.
I think that the presence of religion in it actually ended up disqualifying it from being used in a school context, which I personally think is too bad, because I think that you can analyze religious stories without using them to proselytize, and that you can actually learn a lot about religion and other people by looking at how stories have been handled. At any rate, I think that its decline has owed partly to the turn away from religion. I think the decline is owed partly to the decline of French as a high cultural language in the United States and in some other places, and then also from the reluctance of people teaching French to use a story that might be perceived as religious in instruction. So the story has had an odd history, because it's been dealt with and mentioned by many, many famous people, but increasingly they came to view it as their individual discovery. So it's there everywhere when you look hard enough, but it's each artist's own private discovery, which I think actually is liberating to an artist, not to feel oppressed by all the past versions, and to feel, what can I possibly contribute when there are all these other versions? And it's actually been in the course of the events associated with the exhibit that I've been doing, it's been fascinating to watch the different children's book authors and graphic forms of it, the stained glass artist, walk around the exhibit and look at how other people treated the story, what elements appealed to them. In some ways, it's a tribute just to the incredible breadth of human imagination in creating and then also in interpreting.
I've seen the virtual exhibit. I haven't actually seen the physical exhibit, but there's a huge range. This jongleur, you think it would be almost a very simple idea that could be looking the same throughout, but everyone has a different interpretation of it. And they're so beautiful and colorful.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that reaction. And as far as the theme goes, some people have made the theme prayer? What's the nature of prayer? Can it be, does it have to be verbal or can it be physical? Some people have made giving the main theme. What is it that we have to offer? And can, as an artist, if you're not confident that what you're doing is great art, can it still constitute a gift to a divine being or a gift to the world? It can be taken as a comment on the need not to rush to making swift judgment, not to judge another person. There are just all sorts of ways, different ways that it's been taken, even though it seems almost ineffably simple when you first come across it.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the beauty of it. And I'm thinking as we're talking that there's a lot of medieval stories that are that flexible, you know, Robin Hood and King Arthur and this one. The Middle Ages seems to lend itself to all of these different interpretations, which is interesting, I think.
It is. And it's also nice to have someone trotting out examples that are positive, because we live in a time when you hear the Middle Ages evoked almost exclusively negatively by people who don't even know roughly chronologically when the period was. So you hear about medieval torture, medieval filth, medieval witch trials, and the worst thing that you can say is that something's positively medieval. There's the whole dark Game of Thrones side. And for me, that's a jolt, because when I was little, and this, you know, I'm not trying to hide my generation. When I was a kid, the White House, say, was portrayed as being a Camelot. And the big Disney film was The Sword in the Stone, which was a positive take on Arthurian literature. And I recoil from the fact that there are people who are appropriating the Middle Ages for sordid political and social purposes. And I also recoil at people who think that because there are people who are grabbing onto the Middle Ages for nefarious purposes, that we should somehow forget about them. We need to know the past, and the Middle Ages is an important and a very rich part of that past.
Oh, absolutely. I absolutely agree with you. And I like this story of the jongleur and the virgin, because it shows a lot more tolerance in Christianity and faith at the time that you don't necessarily expect when you think of witch trials and burnings and torture and things like that, when actually people are a lot more flexible in their faith than we might imagine.
No, I couldn't agree more. And I think that the story speaks to the kind of feverish experimentation that happened in the greater 12th century, running, say, from, 1066 up through 1215, when people were thinking really hard about what Christianity should be, and were actually having a 1960-ish kind of creativity in remaking different institutions to get back to what the apostolic life was like as they imagined it. And part of it was allowing people from the, let's say, the working class to have purchase, to have a place, and not to be ignored or crushed by the hierarchy. And so the story speaks to a time when monasteries were taking in lay people. They needed them for certain types of work, but they also wanted to enable them to have a place in the world of religion that they'd been denied before.
And that's making me think back to your exhibition, which deals with not just the story, but also medievalisms from the late 19th century and the 20th century. So Gothic architecture and also these things that bring out the beauty that was the Middle Ages. And in those ones, it's kind of interesting. A lot of those ones will focus on the aristocracy, the knights and the ladies and stuff. But then also in your exhibit, you have this poor juggler in the middle of it. So what kind of stuff were you planning to pull out in terms of medievalisms? What was the goal for that, for this exhibit?
Okay, so look, I will admit to some things autobiographically. Not a lot, and don't get. But so I've been living in Washington since 2007, and I have to fly frequently to the Boston-Cambridge area, which is where I teach. And on the way back from the airport in particular, when I'm tired, I just look out the window and I see the Jefferson Memorial and the Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Monument. And I started thinking of D.C. as being a kind of Greco-Roman theme park because people in the early generations turned to Greece and Rome for architectural models, in particular for the buildings relating to legislation and judiciary. But then I realized that the three tallest buildings in the city are actually in medieval styles of architecture, the National Cathedral, the National Shrine, and then the building that's often referred to as the old post office building, which is a hotel that belongs to the current president. So there are these medieval buildings. And so I started thinking, I should have thought about it long ago, why is it that people in the New World, when they were coming into vast amounts of money for the first time, when they were the big booming developing countries, referring to both the United States and Canada, that people abroad were looking at, why on earth would they turn to the Middle Ages? And what I realized was that systematically, when they were thinking of spirituality, when they were thinking of education, and when they were thinking of culture, they were thinking of the Middle Ages. And so they put in vast amounts of money to building universities that looked like Oxbridge, to building skyscrapers that looked as if they were cathedrals on steroids, and then that they actually were willing to pay to bring over whole abbeys, whole monasteries from France and Spain, so that you find those in most famously in the cloisters in Manhattan, but in probably 10 or 12 other states in the United States. I mean, very strange phenomenon, but part of our experience as North Americans that makes us associate the Middle Ages not just with those dark forces that I mentioned before, but also with something positive. And so that's something that I try to bring out a little bit in the exhibit, the architecture. And then also just the way that a person who was born in 1840, who died in 1920, would have had to adjust to the spread of telegraphy, the railroad going coast to coast, the invention of the automobile, the invention of the airplane, the invention of the radio, the invention of still photography, the invention of moving photography, sound recording, x-rays, discovery of nuclear power. And this is putting aside large social changes such as industrialization, urbanization, and all the pressures coming from those. And all of this made the past become a kind of solace, thinking of a ye old time, thinking of Yule logs and medieval jesters and a world of knights and damsels that they could look at as being simpler and purer. It brought tranquility to people. They needed it. It may not have been a completely accurate view, but it was no more inaccurate than our own most common stereotypes are.
That's a really good point and neatly made. So thank you for that. This exhibit is put on by Dumbarton Oaks. So I think it's worth mentioning, what is the mission of Dumbarton Oaks?
So Dumbarton Oaks is an archetype of that peculiar American phenomenon of big individual donor-driven philanthropy. There was a very wealthy couple, and their names were Mildred Barnes Bliss and Robert Woods Bliss. They each came from moneyed families. Their siblings passed away. The fortunes became concentrated in them. They had no children. And this place that they bought in 1920, Dumbarton Oaks, became very much their child. They saw the horrors of World War I. He was a diplomat. They were posted to Paris from 1914 to 1920. And as they saw World War II drawing near, they wanted to project into the future the culture that they'd been exposed to and to give people a taste of the way of life that they'd experienced. And so they set up, bizarrely, an institute devoted to Byzantine and medieval studies in 1940. They lived on until 1962 and 1969, respectively. The money had built up enough so that they also ended up supporting pre-Columbian studies and garden and landscape studies. But they wanted this to be a place for fellows to pursue advanced research, but they also wanted it to be a place where what they had collected, beauty that they had appreciated, could be shared with the public. So that's art, that's music, and then the garden that they so carefully built. So it's actually, to me, still, as the director of the institution, a very moving and generous vision. And my job is to figure out how to maintain for the 21st century in the best way what they put together for the second half of the 20th. It's a very different world, but a lot of the basic mission still resonates, I think.
Yeah, and it comes through in the selections that you make for your books. So just quickly, some of my favorite books that have come through Dumbarton Oaks are The White Ship, which talks about, you know, proverbs from the Middle Ages. I love that one. And just a few things like The Rule of Saint Benedict, where you can see it in Latin, you can see it in English, but they kind of get at a cultural view of the Middle Ages, which I think is generous and gets at the complicated nature of the Middle Ages. So I love the books from Dumbarton Oaks.
Again, that just makes me so happy. So we have well over 50 now, and the series are Byzantine Greek, because that's what we were first established to accomplish, medieval Latin and Old English. And we're hoping soon to add another sub-series that will be on the Romance languages and maybe later all the languages of medieval Iberia. And to try to put before people in aesthetically pleasing volumes the original languages and then good translations, and to give people pleasure in reading and in engaging directly with text from this incredibly rich and wonderful past.
Well, I enjoy them, so thanks for that work. Before we go, is there anything else you'd like to tell us about the exhibit? It runs until the end of February, so there's still lots of time to see it. Is there anything else you'd like to share with people?
I would just love to have as many people come in who would be interested as we can get. Nothing pleases me more than the thought of people coming in, enjoying the exhibit, and possibly going off, if they've come in a group, if they've come in a family, with those people, or finding other people with whom they can talk about what they've seen and exchange thoughts, exchange interpretations, because we need all of us to be talking more and better and in a kindlier way with each other if we're to get to a better place than where we are right now. And I'm confident that we can do that. And the Middle Ages have a part in it.
Well, absolutely. You're preaching to the choir now. Thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck with the exhibit.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you to everyone who's listened in. And come on while it's up, and if you can't, go to the website.
Beautiful. Thanks. To learn more about the Juggling the Middle Ages exhibit at Dumbarton Oaks, or to take a virtual tour, you can visit jugglingthemiddleages.com. If you can't make it out to Washington but want to check out a really comprehensive history of this story and its impact, you can read Yan's amazing 6-volume work on the subject called The Juggler of Notre Dame and the Medievalizing of Modernity. Yan has very generously made the whole set available online for free through Open Book Publishers. You can find it at jugglingthemiddleages.com/book. You can also follow Dumbarton Oaks on Twitter to see what they're up to at Dumbarton Oaks. That's D-U-M-B-A-R-T-O-N Oaks. Before we go, we have Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. So what's new, Peter?
Hi, Danielle. We've got a few things I wanted to share with you. First of all, is Andrew Latham is starting a look at the Northern Crusades. So he's just kind of finished his kind of Holy Land Crusades that went over about several articles. Now he's doing a three-part series looking at the fight in the Baltics. So we've got that. Minji Su wrote up a piece about this African woman named Ellen Moore, who was at the court of the Scottish King James IV. That was a really interesting read. And if you really want to know, you can find out which Chaucer character you are. So you can play a small game for that. So I always keep getting Chaucer himself. I don't know why. But that's what we got on the website this week.
Awesome. Thanks, Peter. Thank you to all of you who have subscribed to the Medieval Podcast, wherever you're listening. It's an absolute pleasure to share my love of history with you every week. Before you get back to your regularly scheduled programming, I'd really appreciate it if you'd take a minute to give the podcast a rating so that we can spread the love even further. Your ratings make it easier for fellow history buffs to find us across channels, so taking a moment to click on those little stars really goes a long way. As always, you can follow medievalists.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists, and you can follow me, Danielle Sapolsky, across social media at 5minmedievalist or 5minutemedievalist. The Walking Dead is back again this weekend. Have you got your copy of the 5-Minute Medievalist's Guide to Surviving the Zombie Apocalypse? You can find it and the 5-Minute Medievalist on Amazon. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thank you so much for listening and for giving us a review. Have yourself a great day.